This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest Eric Schlosser writes that there are thousands of nuclear missiles in the world today, hidden away and ready to go, awaiting the right electrical signal. They are, he writes, a collective death wish, barely suppressed. Every one is an accident waiting to happen, a potential act of mass murder. Schlosser's new book is a critical look at the history of our nuclear weapons systems and a terrifying account of the fires, explosions, false attack alerts, and accidentally dropped bombs that plagued America's military throughout the Cold War. Schlosser's an investigative reporter probably best known for Fast Food Nation, his look at the practices of the meatpacking and fast food industries. He's also written the book Reefer Madness. Schlosser spent 6 years researching America's nuclear weapons, examining government documents, and interviewing many involved in developing defense policy and in maintaining and deploying weapons systems. His book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety, is out in paperback later this month. Eric Schlosser, welcome back to Fresh Air. I grew up in the Cold War, and I knew, of course, that nuclear weapons were out there and had incredible death-dealing power, but I somehow always thought that they were carefully maintained by people in, you know, these moon suits and booties, and there were always these, you know, triple redundant systems to avoid mistakes. And your book tells a really different story. I thought we should cover just a couple of the more chilling episodes that you document. One of them takes place in 1961. A B-52 takes off from a base in North Carolina with two hydrogen bombs aboard. You want to tell us what happened then?
Yeah, and this plane was on a routine flight. At that period, we had B-52 bombers in the air 24 hours a day, ready to attack the Soviet Union. So this plane took off with two very powerful hydrogen bombs. And while it was flying, the pilot noticed there was a weight imbalance. And they needed to essentially dump their fuel and get back to the base. And while they were trying to get back to the base, the weight imbalance started to break apart the plane. And as the B-52 bomber broke apart midair, the crew was evacuating. And there was a lanyard in the cockpit. And it was the lanyard that one of the crew members would normally pull to release the hydrogen bombs. And the centrifugal forces of the plane breaking apart pulled the lanyard as though a human being had pulled it. Now, these bombs are dumb machines, and they didn't know the difference between a person pulling on the lanyard or centrifugal forces. So the bombs were released as though we were over enemy territory and at war. One of those hydrogen bombs went through all of its proper arming steps except for one. And when it hit the ground in North Carolina, there was a firing signal sent. And if that one switch in the bomb had been switched, it would have detonated full scale an enormous, enormous thermonuclear explosion in North Carolina. And it would have changed the course of history. This was just a few days after John F. Kennedy was inaugurated in a period of great optimism. And if this hydrogen bomb had detonated in North Carolina, it would have sent lethal radioactive fallout as far north, perhaps, as Washington, D.C., and it would have been a catastrophe.
In 1979, by then, a lot of our weapons are on missiles, and we have this system for detecting when there might be a Soviet attack. And the detection system sent some alarming signals to military commanders. What happened then?
Well, by the late 1970s, the great threat to the United States was Soviet missiles. And these would come very quickly. And so the President of the United States would not have very much time whether to decide if this was a real attack or a false alarm and whether to launch our missiles. It might be as few as 10, 12 minutes to make this decision. And at about 11 o'clock in the morning on November 9, 1979, at NORAD headquarters inside Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado Springs, Colorado, suddenly the screens were filled with images of a major Soviet attack on the United States. It really looked like an all-out attack and that the president might have to make a decision about whether to respond. It was investigated very quickly, and other radars showed no sign of this attack. The decision was made that this was a false alarm, and it was soon realized that someone had inadvertently put a training tape, and the training tape was of an all-out Soviet attack, into a computer, and the computer had presented the training tape as a real attack. So that was a false alarm. You know, nothing was done as a result of it. But on June 3rd, 1980, we had another serious incident at 2:30 in the morning when Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, was awoken at 2:30 in the morning and told by his military aide the United States was most likely under attack by 220 missiles. And as Brzezinski said, I need confirmation of that, and his military aide got off the phone, and the military aide called back Brzezinski and said it's actually 2,200 Soviet missiles are coming towards the United States. And Brzezinski wanted further confirmation, and as he lay there in bed in the early morning hours, he decided not to wake up his wife, because if Washington, D.C. was about to be destroyed, he preferred that she die in her sleep. And Brzezinski was preparing to call President Carter to talk about the American retaliation, and his military aide called back one more time, said it was a false alarm. And this false alarm was later traced to a faulty computer chip that cost 46 cents that had malfunctioned and had sent the signal that 2,000 Soviet missiles with their warheads were on the way.
Eric Schlosser's book is Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. It's out in hardback and will be out in paperback later this month. I want to talk a bit about how we got where we are in terms of this kind of a nuclear arsenal and the way it's managed. You have some fascinating information about the early history. Of course, America developed atomic weapons at the end of World War II. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about some of those early weapons. They were pretty large, clunky things, weren't they?
And they were created in the age of the slide rule. This was very rudimentary technology. We developed nuclear weapons because there was a fear that Nazi Germany was developing them as well. And this was in the height of the Second World War. And the fact that they wound up being used against Japan, it wasn't the original intention. And historians, you know, debate whether or not the use of two nuclear weapons against Japan ended the war with Japan. But certainly that was the perception. The early nuclear weapons were essentially handmade. In the book, I write about the test of the first nuclear device at Alamogordo in New Mexico in July 1945, and the nuclear core of that first nuclear device was literally put together by hand in a farmhouse. And you see these things, and they look like laboratory experiments from a 1930s horror film, like Dr. Frankenstein could create. But even though there were these rudimentary handmade devices, they worked. And the amount of devastation that they could create was extraordinary. In the case of Hiroshima, the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was an incredibly crude and inefficient weapon. When it exploded, about 99% of the uranium that was supposed to undergo this chain reaction didn't. It just blew apart in the air. And a very small percentage, maybe 2% of the fissile material actually detonated, and most of it just became other radioactive elements. So when you look at the destruction of Hiroshima, this major city destroyed in an instant, and 80,000 people were killed, and 2/3 of the buildings in this enormous metropolitan area were destroyed instantly because 7/10 of a gram of uranium-235 became pure energy. Now, to imagine how small an amount that is, 7/10 of a gram of uranium is about the size of a peppercorn. 7/10 of a gram weighs less than a dollar bill. So even though this weapon was unbelievably inefficient and almost, you know, 99% of the uranium had nothing to do with the destruction of Hiroshima, it was a catastrophic explosion. And nuclear weapons since then have become remarkably efficient and small and capable of devastation that makes Hiroshima seem trivial.
And accidents were a part of the nuclear program from the beginning. And one of the more horrific involved this engineer named Lewis Slotin. Do I have the name right? In 1946? Yeah. You want to just quickly tell us what happened?
Lewis Slotin.
Slotin, okay.
Well, I mentioned that the first nuclear core for the first detonation of a nuclear device was assembled by hand in a farmhouse. And it was assembled by Lewis Slotin, who was one of the Manhattan Project scientists. He did some of the most daring experiments, and so many of these things were done by hand. And he was doing an experiment at the lab in which he was showing others how a chain reaction worked, and he had two spheres of plutonium that were separated by a screwdriver. And the screwdriver slipped out of his hand, and the plutonium instantly started a chain reaction, and there was a bright blue flash, and he was able to push apart the spheres very quickly so that the other people in the room weren't killed. But in that instant, he absorbed a lethal dose of radioactivity. His death was through radiation poisoning was slow. It was very painful. But in order to stress to future Manhattan Project scientists and nuclear engineers the importance of safety procedures, he agreed to have his death by radiation poisoning filmed. It was horrific, and that footage was later shown far and wide to people who worked on nuclear weapons as an example of what can happen when you're not careful.
There's one accident that you tell in great detail in the book, and this involves a Titan II missile. Tell us about this weapon, what it does, how it works.
The Titan II was the largest intercontinental ballistic missile that the United States ever built. It was about the size of a 10-story building. It was enormous. And on top of it was the most powerful nuclear warhead that the United States ever built. The one warhead on a Titan II had three times the explosive force of all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. It was an unbelievably powerful warhead.
And this is at an underground missile silo, which is where these weapons were stored. Just tell us a little bit about kind of the two stages of the weapon and what kind of an underground complex there was to manage it and launch it when necessary.
Yeah. Well, there was a deep silo to contain this 100-foot-tall missile. And the missile contained two different propellants. One was a rocket fuel. The other was known as an oxidizer. And when the two mixed, they'd catch on fire, and that's what would propel the missile up into the air. So it was very important to keep these two propellants separate, and there were separate tanks in the missile for that purpose. One day, they were doing routine maintenance in the silo, and there was a workman standing on a steel platform near the top of the missile doing something that these guys did all the time, something you do without even thinking about, you know, adding a little pressure to one of the tanks. And he was standing on a steel work platform near the top, and the socket fell off of his tool, and it hit the steel work platform, bounced. He reached for it and just missed it, and it fell in between this very narrow gap in between the steel work platform and the missile. It dropped about 70 feet down, hit the wall of the silo, ricocheted, and hit the missile. And when it hit the missile, it tore a small hole in the steel skin of the missile, and suddenly thousands of gallons of highly explosive, highly toxic, highly flammable rocket fuel were pouring out of the missile into the silo. And so there was suddenly this problem that the Air Force had never encountered before and literally didn't know what to do. Not only was this flammable rocket fuel filling the silo, but there was this other propellant, the oxidizer, which if it touched the fuel would ignite, was in the tanks of the missile.
There's an incredibly gripping account of how this unfolds, and folks can read that in the book. One of the things that's striking about that account is as you know, there were a lot of people at the silo when the socket was dropped and when the leak occurred. And then, of course, other people were summoned in Arkansas and eventually in Omaha at higher levels of the military command. And as people tried to figure out what to do, there were drastically different suggestions as to whether you should take the top of the silo off to vent it or whether you should try and go in, send somebody in. And we won't go into all of that here, but what does the delay and confusion in dealing with all of that. Tell us about the challenges of dealing with this kind of technology.
Yeah. For me, the story was important not only because the details of it to me are incredible, and there's remarkable personal heroism of the young airmen who go into a highly dangerous environment to try to save the missile, but the story to me is an illustration of how hard it is to control complex technological systems, especially when something goes wrong. The Titan II missile had been on alert in silos in the United States for years, for almost 20 years when this accident occurred. They had routine checklists and standard operating procedures for how to do everything for this missile. And then when something goes wrong, they had no idea what to do, and they debated what to do. And the people who were near the missile, who knew the most about the missile, weren't allowed to make the decisions. The decisions were made by a Strategic Air Command general hundreds of miles away in Omaha, Nebraska, who knew very little about the missile.
So let's take us back to this moment at this missile silo in Arkansas. There's a decision to turn on an exhaust fan. Just briefly, what happens then?
Well, two young airmen had risked their lives going into a silo that was full of explosive fuel vapor. The concentrations were so high there was concerns that just by walking through the vapor you could ignite it because of the friction of your body. And they realized it was a dangerous situation, and they were getting ready to leave, and someone over the radio suggested maybe a ventilation fan should be turned on to get some of the fuel vapor out of the silo. And it's not clear if the young airman was ordered to do it or misunderstood what was being said. The radio communications were poor, and again, there was just a litany of technological problems in addition to the accident. And in this case, they turned on the fan and got ready to leave the silo. And then there was just a massive, massive explosion as the missile went up in flames.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the destruction and the injuries that resulted.
Well, this was a missile silo that had been designed to survive a nuclear strike from the Soviet Union. And the explosion of this Titan II missile just sent enormous, gigantic chunks of concrete wearing tons, hundreds and hundreds of feet into the air. The door of the silo, which weighed hundreds of tons, was sent flying into a nearby forest. And the most concerning thing was that the nuclear warhead on top of the missile, this powerful warhead, was launched into the air and landed somewhere, and nobody knew where it was. And then there was this hunt to find this warhead in the early morning hour darkness and amid total confusion and chaos. And when accidents like this happen, you never really know how you're going to respond. In this case, most of the airmen fled the scene, were ordered to leave the scene. Even most of the disaster response force that had been sent there to handle the disaster fled the scene. And a small group of men stayed behind to rescue the injured and to try to find this powerful warhead that somewhere was in rural Arkansas.
You know, in the book, you give a lot of people credit for trying to exercise better control of our nuclear weapons, and you explore how various presidents sought to gain better control. Let's talk about what's going on today. The Cold War is over, but there's still an awful lot of weapons out there, and we have an increasingly contentious relationship with Russia. How do you feel about things now?
I'm quite concerned. The good news is the number of weapons is vastly lower than it was at the height of the Cold War. At the height of the Cold War, the United States had more than 31,000 nuclear weapons, most of them vastly more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima. And because of the perverse mentality of the arms race, the Soviet Union decided they would be more powerful if they had more weapons. So the Soviet Union had 35,000 nuclear weapons. That's extraordinary. Today, the United States has perhaps 2,000 deployed nuclear weapons, and Russia has perhaps 3,000, maybe 4,000. So the numbers are much lower, and that's a good thing. The fewer weapons, the less likely there is to be an accident or somebody misusing a weapon. The problem today is that we have very aging weapon systems, both in the United States and Russia. It's very old technology. Our principal nuclear bomber, the B-52, hasn't been built since John F. Kennedy was president. Our principal land-based missile, the Minuteman III, was put into the ground originally in 1970, was supposed to be retired in the early 1980s, and the infrastructure is aging. The wiring, the computers in our Minuteman launch complexes use 9-inch floppy disks. So there's all kinds of potential for problem there, and in Russia, the same thing. Their early warning system is aging. So you don't want the command and control systems of the United States and Russia to have to go on heightened alert for any reason like they did in the Cold War, firstly, because the equipment is so old, and secondly, because we don't have officers who have experience of dealing with a nuclear crisis. During the Cold War, our officers had to deal with the invasion of Hungary and the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they'd been through these sorts of tensions.
Do you know whether mishaps with American nuclear weapons are less common today than they were, I mean, proportionally, in the 70s and 80s?
To my knowledge, there has not been an American major nuclear weapon accident since the Damascus accident that's the focus of my book. However, in 2007, there was a very, very serious incident involving half a dozen nuclear cruise missiles of ours. They were accidentally loaded onto a B-52 bomber. The ground crew had no idea that there were nuclear warheads on the cruise missiles when they put them on the plane. The pilot of the B-52 didn't realize that her plane had nuclear weapons on board. The plane flew across the United States, and we've had rules in place since 1968 that nuclear weapons are not supposed to be flown over the continental United States because of the risk of accidents. And then the bomber was parked on a runway at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana for hours without anyone realizing that nuclear weapons were on board. So for a day and a half, the Air Force effectively didn't know that half a dozen nuclear weapons were missing. And that's a very, very serious incident. You can do a perfect job of maintaining control of 1,999 nuclear weapons, but if you lose one, that's a big problem.
Eric Schlosser, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Schlosser's book, Command and Control, will be out in paperback later this month. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. The rock band Spoon formed in Austin, Texas, 20 years ago. Since then, the group's achieved both critical and commercial success. Its songs are used extensively as mood music by TV producers and have been heard in such shows as The Simpsons, House, Bones, How I Met Your Mother, and the Showtime series Shameless. Spoon's new album, the group's first release since 2010, is called They Want My Soul. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Will you call me your baby? You hurt me, I just don't understand. Well, you say that you need me like an ocean needs sand, but the way you mistreat me, I just don't understand. Well, you know that I love you.
I'd say that that song, I Just Don't Understand, is a classic Spoon song full of raw romantic disappointment and frustration set to a catchy beat, except for one thing. It's not a Spoon song. It's a cover of a 1961 single recorded by the actress Anne Margaret, back when sex kittens cut pop songs for fun and profit. Yet in another way, it's a perfect example of what Spoon does. The band has impeccable taste in material to cover, as well as being able to invest almost any song with a certain kind of urgency that's immediately recognizable.
Ah!
Rent I Pay, on which singer-guitarist-songwriter Britt Daniel allows his trademark hoarse, ragged vocal to get pushed around by slamming drums and slashed guitar chords. The title phrase is meant to be understood as the price one pays for trying to live with someone. And speaking of slashed sounds, listen to the squawky rave-up that occurs midway through another song, Knock Knock Knock. It deploys distortion to mimic the effect of a manic state of mind.
You said you were living in a buttoned-up world, living in 1892. Say to convince me or to blame nobody but you.
The lyrics on this album are assiduously elliptical, standard operating procedure for Spoon. There's a joke or two tucked in here and there, as when, on the song Outlier, Daniel sings, "You walked out on Garden State, 'cause you had taste." And I'm betting he's referring to the 2004 Zach Braff movie rather than the state of New Jersey itself. Still, most of the time, the words give up few clear meanings other than puzzlement over the ways of romance that the music is invariably more effective at illustrating. This collection, They Want My Soul, is another fine Spoon album in a career that has now come to display a remarkable consistency, which for some listeners will signify as more of the same thing. But keep listening, and beyond the usual twisting melodies and Britt Daniel's disarming melancholy, They Want My Soul reveals one possible meaning of its title. There's a soulfulness here that anyone would envy, would want with all one's heart.
Ken Tucker reviewed the album They Want My Soul from the band Spoon. It's easy to take the miracles of modern medicine for granted, but a new TV series reminds us there was a day when somebody had to be the first person to get an appendectomy, and some doctor had to be the first to try and open a woman's abdomen and deliver a baby by cesarean section. The series, called The Nick, is set in a turn-of-the-century New York hospital, when surgeons were developing new techniques and inventions in a city teeming with immigrants and steeped in corrupt institutions. The operating scenes are graphic, and the relationships among the characters reflect the social and racial tensions of the period. The series is directed by Steven Soderbergh and stars Clive Owen. Our guests today are the series' creators and writers, Jack Amiel and Michael Begler. They've been a writing team since the 90s for television and film. Also joining us is Dr. Stanley Burns, a photographic and medical historian who's a technical advisor to the series, which airs Friday nights on Cinemax. In this scene, the brilliant surgeon John Thackeray, played by Clive Owen, is about to begin a procedure in the operating theater of the hospital. He's addressing an audience of other doctors and students while the patient is awake and sitting on the operating table.
Gentlemen, Before you is a patient who was infected with septicemia from his bowel. Normally, we would induce surgical sleep with ether, but due to a severe case of bronchitis he has developed postoperatively, we cannot. We must operate, but we cannot do it to a man who can feel pain. My solution? Numb the nerves in the spine between the thoracic vertebrae 6 and 7 so as to stop the brain from learning of the pain. I intend to inject a 2% cocaine solution directly into Mr. Gentile's spinal canal, low enough not to affect the heart and lungs, high enough to dull everything below.
My God, won't that paralyze him?
Not if he makes for the hollow canal in the subarachnoid space.
It's been tried once before on a Labrador retriever.
What happened?
There isn't a day goes by where I don't miss that dog. If you could attempt to suppress your cough.
Well, Jack Amiel, Michael Begler, Dr. Stanley Burns, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the series. It's gotten a lot of great reviews, although a couple have mentioned you might not want to watch it right after a meal. One of the fascinating things about these operating scenes is that we have an operating room floor and then this big amphitheater where there's a huge crowd watching, and the doctor is describing what he's doing kind of like an entertainer introducing his act. Is that the way it went back in turn of the century?
Yes, it was. The operating amphitheater was the way surgeons taught. And the most revered professors sat in the first row and the young interns in the top row. And this was a standard way. Often the doctors would turn around and lecture to the crowd. The doctors who lived 100 years ago, 200 years ago, were just as smart, just as innovative, just as inventive as we are. But they labored under inferior technology and knowledge.
The other thing I notice about this scene and others is the way the doctors speak about the patients while they are right there listening. I mean, Dr. Thackeray here is saying he's going to try this procedure, which was attempted once on a dog, and he doesn't go a day without missing that dog. The patient is awake and hearing this. Anybody want to comment on that kind of bedside manner?
Well, I collect photography, and when they took photographs of patients, they didn't cover genitalia, they didn't cover their face, and the patients were to be were of the mindset of appreciative of the care that they were getting, and that they were basically teaching cases, and we see that in this particular example.
I'd also add, medicine hadn't advanced to a place where anybody assumed they were going to live from it. So anything a doctor did was simply reversing fate. And so that I think the doctors felt more free, at least our doctors that we created, felt more free to speak in front of them because the reality was always there. There is no facade of you'll probably get better.
I'd like to say something to that. That until the advent of surgery that's depicted in this era at the turn of the century, hospitals were looked at as a place to die. And it was because of the accomplishments of the surgeons at the turn of the century that people realized they can go to a hospital, get operated on, and live. And the surgeons were the ones who helped create the modern American hospital system as a result of this.
Dr. Burns, is it true that you have a collection of over 1 million vintage photographs, mostly in your home?
Yes, that's true. And the largest part of the collection is my medical photography collection and my memorial postmortem photograph collection.
Those are photographs that people take when? Of dead ones? Of their lost loved ones or as they're about to die? What is that?
It's both. And during the 19th century, this was a very common practice. This was just a way of memorializing a loved one. We remove death from everyday life. And as I think it was Jack who mentioned it before, this was a normal part of life. And it was only until after World War I that we had the major advances where people could expect to live to a ripe old age. The advance of medicine drove us from a lifespan of 47 in 1900 to the 80s at the end of the century.
Jack or Michael, can you think of a photograph or a procedure that you saw at Dr. Burns' archive there that particularly impressed you or inspired a story or a scene?
Well, I can say that when we first went there, the first time, the very first photograph that Dr. Burns showed us was of an African-American surgeon in Paris, and he is the lead surgeon, and he is surrounded by a white staff. And I think this is one of the only photographs that existed of this. And we had already written the pilot at this point, but to see evidence of what we had created was astounding.
This is a black surgeon surrounded by a white staff in France.
Surgeon surrounded by a white staff, but in Paris, because black doctors here in the United States couldn't work in a hospital. They would probably work in the best they could do is work in a Negro infirmary. But if they went over to Europe, they could study with the best doctors, the best researchers, and work side by side. So that's what we in our character of Algernon Edwards, that's what we depict. And so to see that photograph was just so affirming and incredible.
Were there African American surgeons in this period? And
there
what
were.
What were their lives like? Yeah.
Well, there were African American medical schools in the South mainly, and they had their own hospitals and their own system of education that was within the parameters and within the norm of medical education at the time. But they couldn't go to major southern cities and be in their hospitals because of strict segregation. As a matter of fact, I'll go the exact opposite way. There was actually a scientific thought, well-worked-out, rational basis for segregation. And this was a major aspect of 19th century, I hate to say it, medicine and science, was finding ways to distinguish the races. And so African Americans were not accepted. They did work in their own infirmaries, and they did have to be educated at their own medical schools. I know one of the liberal schools at the time in the 1880s was the University of Michigan. I think I have a photograph that has five African Americans in that class, but that was highly unusual.
Jack Amiel and Michael Begler are the creators and writers of the series The Nick. Dr. Stanley Burns was a technical advisor to the series. The Nick stars Clive Owen as Dr. John Thackeray. In this scene, he's delivering a eulogy at the funeral of a colleague.
We now live in a time of endless possibility. More has been learned about the treatment of the human body in the last 5 years than was learned in the previous 500. 20 years ago, 39 was the number of years a man could expect from his life. Today it is more than 47. Eventually the train tunnels will crumble. The dams will be overrun. Our patients' hearts will all stop their beating. But we humans can get in a few good licks in battle before we surrender.
The lead character here, the brilliant surgeon, Dr. John Thackeray, played by Clive Owen, is addicted to cocaine. Was that common at the time?
Well, unfortunately it was. One of the principles of medicine at the time was that doctors practiced on themselves. There's doctors who, like a Dr. Henry Head, who cut his own nerves in his hand to see what innovation was like. And when cocaine came out, it was a miracle drug. It was being experimented with for infiltrative local anesthesia, which freed the patient from the horrendous effects of general anesthesia, where they used ether and chloroform. And doctors routinely took those medications and every other medication to see the effects. And unfortunately, William Halstead, for which Dr. Thackeray is modeled after to some extent, was a cocaine addict when he was in New York City here. And one of his close associates, another doctor, died from an overdose. And they were using it to see the effects on the human body by injecting themselves, not realizing how addictive it was.
I'm wondering kind of what dramatic possibilities it presents to have your lead actor, your lead character on cocaine. I mean, it struck me that, I don't know, that sort of edgy, sort of scary focus that you might get with cocaine would would fit with being on the cutting edge of surgery, you know, experimenting at very high stakes.
Well, I think what we wanted from this character is a guy who's always going forward. And the amount of bodies he has left behind is so great that I don't think he could function without something that sort of put that at bay. You know, in the pilot, it becomes too much for Dr. Christensen. And as people saw, he committed suicide. And in episode two, this is not giving anything away, but Thackeray says to Christensen's widow that Christensen stopped seeing the procedure and he started seeing the patient. And so for Thackeray, the way to cope without for not seeing the patient and just seeing the procedure was to use this cocaine to kind of keep his focus and his drive and his endurance to keep moving medicine forward.
I'd like to add here that this, of course, was one of the great issues during the 20th century. As the doctor became more emotionally removed from the patient, and the humanism is being slowly brought back into medical schools with the creation of medical humanities departments with their emphasis on treating the patient as a human being before you worry about his disease. It's not a disease with a patient. I remember going to school where, you know, I would say, and making rounds where we didn't discuss, this is Mr. Jones, we'd say, this is the gallbladder, and this is the stomach cancer, and this is the... And today the emphasis is on the personal touch, so that we do have to have that true empathy for what the patient is going through. And this is a great change in medicine. And with the amount of technology and the advances we have, it's rightly so, and just a little late in coming.
We also like to marry the idea of technology with medicine. And what I mean by that is, in the opening episode, we have the hospital being wired for electricity. And so Jack and I thought, well, how do we now use the electricity in the theater? So we went about researching for different procedures that actually used electricity to the benefit of the patient. But sometimes this had really good results, and sometimes it had really awful results.
One of the things that I noticed is a lot of the scenes are dimly lit, and I suppose this is the way people saw things back then, when they often relied on, you know, natural lighting, and electric lights were just, you know, coming into use. Was that a way that you writers envisioned it?
The dim lighting was Steven Soderbergh's brilliant choice, and it was real. This was not an era when you had high wattage light bulbs and everything was lit. It was an era when this was all new and not everything was wired for electricity. And we wanted the reality of the darkness and the grit and what life really was like. Technology, ironically, helped us with this because Steven uses a camera called the Red Dragon. And it has such an incredibly sensitive light sensor that you can be in a room where two characters are only lit by one candle in the center of a table, and you can shoot that scene. It is extraordinary. And so Steven really took advantage of that and allowed us to see what the darkness really was back then. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's something you don't see in anything else. Steven also mentioned something that I thought was really interesting, which is that he was kept trying to figure out why there was a different quality to this show than anything he'd done before. When he was editing it, he kept looking at it. And what he noticed was that the actors' eyes were different, and it was because they weren't in bright light. So instead of dialing down their pupils, they were wide open, and it had a whole different effect and a sense of openness that I don't think many other productions have ever been able to capture.
It is interesting to consider how different the life of a surgeon is today, where there are so many specialties and so much equipment, and you do so many of these things, from back then when they were kind of figuring it out. How does that help you kind of shape the characters?
I think we just looked at them, especially someone like Thackeray, as an explorer. They were pioneers, you know, and what was the mindset of of an explorer. You know, how far would they go? I think of someone like Percy Fawcett, who spent his life searching for this lost city. In the same way, I think of Thackeray in that way, that he's searching for these things that are almost impossible to find sometimes, but that he has this drive to keep going forward. And yes, today it is about specializing, but back then they couldn't specialize because they didn't have enough knowledge to focus on just a certain part of the body, or a certain system within the body. They had to first learn all about that, and we now live in a time where you can do that thanks to the men of the early 20th century.
Well, Jack Amiel, Michael Begler, congratulations on the series, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
Dr. Stanley Burns, thanks for joining us also.
Well, thank you. It's been a great privilege.
Dr. Stanley Burns is a photographic and medical historian who's a technical advisor to the new TV series, The Nick. Jack Amiel and Michael Begler are the creators and writers of the show. It airs Friday nights on Cinemax. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.